Welcome to the Apologia podcast, the audio-only archive of the Apologia YouTube channel. Note that some content was designed to go with visuals, but the imagination can be a powerful thing. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on the podcast app you're using now to help us reach more people. Or, since this endeavor is ad-free, consider going a step further and supporting us for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/apologia. But for now, let's get to the episode. Part of the Apologetic series, recorded February 3rd, 2022, titled Who Deconstructs the Deconstructors, featuring John Steingard.
Well, nowadays, kids are entertaining themselves, teens, you know, millennials and younger, are watching YouTube.
They are. Why is this the first I'm hearing of this?
I mean, I don't know how much of it's, you know, scripted or not.
Some from column A, some from column B.
Then all of a sudden they come out with these, you know, hour and a half long program of why I'm no longer a Christian.
I think we can do it in less than that.
And yeah. And there's impact there.
Here's hoping. Welcome to Apologia, where a former Christian takes a look at the claims of Christians. And today, the claims on the Stand to Reason podcast are actually about former Christians.
Welcome, this is Stand to Reason, and I'm your host today, John Noyes, filling in for the amazing Gregory Kokel, and I'm not alone today in studio.
I'm not alone today in studio either. If John can have help, then I think I should be able to call in help. And who better when it comes to problem of evil, deconversion stories, than John Steingard. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Speaking of people who are international.
This is great, because we also have one of us coming from Canada, and one of us coming from the States, and
one of us named... both of us Canadian. And I love how it's the far-off land of Canada.
Yes, I don't really feel it's quite international per se.
I guess it is technically, but yeah, I come from this exotic place called Canada.
And I told you, you could do this all on your own, man. You got a lot to say, but I'm just happy to come along for the ride, you know, to ride shotgun with you.
I feel like Tim in this show. I feel like the John has a lot to say. You've got the reins, my friend. I know it's my channel, but this will largely be your show.
This is your show. I'm just along for the ride. Right there. Already I can't. Yeah, so, I mean, I just don't think that this is an accurate representation of what the problem really is, right? What we see, the level of suffering we see in the world is what you'd expect if we lived in a world, in a universe that was not created by an all-powerful, all-loving God. And for me, I think the problem isn't even the existence of God or not the existence of God. It's the existence of God with all the omni traits, all-knowing, all-powerful, all-loving. The best way to think about the problem of evil is the version popularized by David Hume, I think. Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he's not omnipotent. If he's able but not willing, then he is malevolent. If he is both able and willing, then from whence comes evil? So he's just pointing out that there's a contradiction between the world that we see and the idea of an all-powerful, all-loving God. And that, I think, is the most concise description of the problem.
For me, I don't actually necessarily believe in the word ought without a qualifier. Right. You ought to run fast if you want to win the race. You just ought to run fast isn't a thing outside of that context.
You're getting into a couple of things. So what you just described is Kant's hypothetical imperative, which basically means if you want this, then you ought to do this. And that's a much simpler way of thinking. It's basically just cause and effect.
Right.
Versus some sort of ethereal, air quotes, objective ought. Because you got to ask the question, why ought I do anything at all? And I think that this touches on another point. It gets a little confusing when we're talking about the problem of evil, because even the word evil has a lot of moral implications built into it. And so I actually prefer to call it the problem of suffering, because it takes the problem out of the moral realm. Because when you start talking about morality, there's this whole field called metaethics, which is the study of what is morality and where do we get our moral intuitions. And it's such a complicated field that for lay people like myself, I don't have the expertise to get into huge meta-ethical questions. So if we can approach the problem of evil in a non-moral way, then sometimes it can help us clear away some of the potential complications. So I think of it as the problem of suffering. And the way that I would say it simply is we see a lot of suffering in the world that intuitively feels like it wouldn't be there if there was an all-loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God. So if you say it like that and talk about suffering rather than evil, it takes the moral aspect out of it and makes the problem a little more clear.
I like that a lot because it also helps alleviate the problem that when I was a Christian, and perhaps you feel the same way, I would have said that evil is both an adjective and a noun, that evil is actually an entity.
Oh.
I think your way of phrasing it can help eliminate potentially some of that friction, even when believers and non-believers are talking to each other.
So just to bring this home, I would rephrase it to something more like, almost everyone agrees that the world is not the way you would expect it to be, given the existence of an all-powerful, all-loving, and all-knowing God. That's how I would reformulate what they're saying on the screen here.
Love it. And it also drives home really well that it's an internal critique of Christianity, as opposed to a materialist being confused as to why some things are better than other things.
That's a good point. Sometimes I have people that say to me, you're like cutting off the branch that you're standing on, especially if we're talking about morality, right? Where do you get your morality? Your morality is not based on anything. Mine's based on the Bible and comes from God and it's rooted in God's nature. And I feel like you can avoid that whole thing if we're just talking about suffering and we're talking about an apparent inconsistency between the definition of God we find in Christianity and the world that we see in our experience.
Exactly. Love it.
There's been this trend recently of Christian artists or pastors or authors and sons or daughters of famous pastors, people in the public eye who were once Christian, they're coming out publicly as saying, you know, I am no longer a Christian. I have deconstructed or deconverted.
John, you fit this category of what they're describing here.
Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't know you well, can you give us just a quick bit of your background?
Yeah, the super short version is basically I was in a Christian band for a really long time, 15 years, a band called Hawk Nelson. And toward the end of our career, I was becoming a father. I wanted to tour less. And around that time, I started just really thinking about some issues to do with my Christian faith that I had always had and I had been brought up in. And I found that the more questions I asked, the more I used the analogy of pulling on threads of a sweater. And I just kept pulling and pulling. And the more questions I asked, the more I felt the answers that I had been given and was continuing to find in Christianity just didn't satisfy me. And eventually it got to a point where I felt like if I was being honest with myself and others, I was like, I don't think I believe in God anymore, which was actually really terrifying. I think sometimes it's painted as this like rebellious thing. You want to go do some sinning. But I think your experience may have involved some of the same things. Of just this sense of, like, wow, I felt like the rug was pulled out from under me and it wasn't necessarily pleasant.
Absolutely. I do remember the last several times I prayed as a believer and how the anguish of that and how it was slipping away and it was a real loss. Like I wasn't gaining anything. I was losing the person that I talked to every couple minutes. It was ripping something away from me.
Yeah, I feel like it's important for believers who are approaching this topic to understand that nobody that I know who's gone through this process, deconstruction, deconversion, whatever you want to call it, nobody that I know has done it flippantly and casually and carelessly. It's a really difficult and painful process, and it's usually undertaken with sincere desire to understand the truth. And if it's characterized any other way, it feels like a real straw man for me.
So we want to set these other like parameters, these boundaries, at least for me when I'm wrestling with these things and other things in general, I set them within my theological context. And once you get your theology there and you let those serve as your bookends, kind of, I look at it like those bumpers that you put down in the bowling alley so you can't get it into the gutter, you know? So you lay that groundwork, God's sovereignty, God's love, God's goodness, you know, God's justice. And now we're free to explore this stuff.
Yeah. Obviously, this is a problem. And it's funny, like, I think when I was a Christian, I might have heard him say this and been like, oh, yeah, I agree with that. without really thinking about what he's saying. Because what he's saying is, it's okay to ask questions about your faith as long as you've already decided you're going to continue believing it no matter what. And when you do that, you're not engaging in honest inquiry. You're not engaging in, hey, I really want to know the truth. What you're saying is, I want to know some truth, but I don't really want to look at the big questions. And I hear a lot of, especially evangelicals, say stuff like this. And I do not understand how you can hear it and believe that this is honest inquiry.
For me, when I was deconverting, what I had to do in order to be intellectually honest with myself and just deal with the cognitive dissonance I was facing was say, let me not assume that it was true. And that's right. When I felt that I could start actually investigating. And that's when all the pieces started coming together. Christians come back to me this a lot. When you read the Bible, are you open to it being true? And I guess I would say the same thing when people who are potentially deconstructing, are you open to it not being true?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think actually, it's not to say that anyone who's a Christian hasn't thought about these things. I do know Christians who have thought about these philosophical issues really deeply and are willing to question their presuppositions, but they've just come to different conclusions that I have. But very commonly, we see what Jonathan is saying here, where it's like there's a dogmatic decision made ahead of time. I am going to decide that these things are true, and then I'll look at everything through that lens. If something is true, it should be able to stand up to scrutiny. And by being unwilling to subject that belief to scrutiny, it's just not a fully open inquiry into what is true.
You sure. know, we got to be careful how we respond to these stories. My first initial reaction is always to combat them with arguments. You know, are you kidding me? You know, the problem of evil? You know, I mean, Tim, how many articles have you written on the problem of evil?
I encounter this pretty often too, where Christians will say, oh, come on, the problem of evil, that's so old and it's been figured out. Like, we have solutions for that. And I just can't believe you don't know the solutions. Like, how could you decide you don't believe in God without even looking at the solutions to your questions? And I just immediately want to respond, what makes you think I haven't looked at them? Like, I understand the free will defense, at least as much as a layperson can, I think. I'm not a professional philosopher. I've heard the counter arguments to some of these problems, and I just don't find them satisfying. And it should be said that there are very many brilliant philosophers on both sides of this debate, both theists and atheists, agnostics. There are very sharp people that disagree on this. And so it's not as though a layperson like myself has no precedent for saying I'm unconvinced by these responses to things like the problem of evil. So to be like incredulous about this and say, I can't believe this is a problem for you is just unhelpful, I think.
If we can relate this to how a Christian might feel at a certain point, imagine someone comes back to you, oh, you believe in the Kalam cosmological argument? There are YouTube videos that totally debunk that.
Right.
It's the same energy, I think,
yeah,
behind
absolutely.
Those things.
We should make it super clear that these are topics that have been discussed for a very long time by very intelligent people. You and I are not likely to solve the sort of problem of evil debate today. And I do think this stuff needs to be approached with a little bit of humility and also just an understanding that this is my opinion. There are reasonable people that disagree with me. And maybe you feel differently. I don't know.
One of the reasons why I like to have people on when we talk about problem evil is that I don't actually think the problem of evil is that great an argument against theism.
Really?
I still am actually quasi-compelled by the Christian answer to it. That a plausible, sufficient moral reason that I, as a non-omnipotent person, can't see right now could exist. And for me, that is still a reasonable out to the problem of evil.
I think I would agree with that. And I think the strongest version of that I've encountered is when you bring in a moral ethical framework called virtue theory, that there are goods that are possible only through experience with not good or with suffering or with evil. It's not implausible to believe that there could be a God that values virtuous creatures and has fashioned a universe that does involve some suffering in order to fashion those virtuous creatures. So I think that's actually the strongest response to the problem of evil that I've encountered. And I do think it's reasonable to believe that. I still have questions. Does there need to be this much suffering? How much suffering?
Right.
How much suffering is sufficient? And would there not be enough good if there was just like a little bit less suffering? Like if a child dies as an infant, is that really creating some good somewhere? Like maybe you're right. We don't know the mind of God if God exists. But this is where it becomes a question of, do you find yourself personally persuaded, convinced, satisfied with that response? And I still find myself going, ah, man, it's a stretch, because you have to say, yeah, God wanted us to suffer this much. And that feels weird to say a little bit.
It does. I think our difference in how important we feel it speaks against one of their enterprises here is that all deconversions are basically the same thing. My deconversion was with the reliability of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could solve the reliability of the Bible problem, I would probably return. The problem of evil wouldn't bother me that much. But someone like Bart Ehrman, who's been on the channel, he has far more study in the reliability of the Bible than I do. But he became an agnostic because of the problem of evil, not because of the Bible stuff. So this idea that you can look at a deconversion or deconstruction and come in assuming that you know.
I see enough problems in various areas. I don't think any one of them is a deal breaker. But I see enough things that I go, hey, something's not right here. And so I consider myself an agnostic. Like, I am open to the idea of God existing. I just have, at the moment, I don't find myself convinced that God does exist. But one of the areas that we haven't talked about that I've continued to be curious about is, it's one thing to ask, is there a God, or does God exist, or are there multiple gods? We have some polytheist friends that, like, sometimes that option doesn't get brought up a lot. And I would also add, like, the nature of God is completely up for debate. So to me, the idea of there being a first cause, a God that created all things, that on its face is not necessarily implausible. I actually think it's when you add all the omni traits, all loving, all powerful, all knowing, that's when I start to experience a lot of questions like, wait, that has a lot of implications that kind of get weird when you introduce all the omni traits. And so I'm much more open to the idea of theism in general, and I have fewer objections to that than I do, say, Christianity, which also has all these other beliefs built into it. I think in these conversations, sometimes it's easy to get tripped up in this duality of no God or the Christian God. And those aren't the only theories on offer. Yeah.
False dichotomies abound.
Yeah.
They're not just arguments. That would be easy. It's easy to answer the arguments, in my opinion.
So he's saying it's easy to answer the arguments, in my opinion. And I just don't think anyone who's willing to say that has really studied all the arguments. I want to give them the benefit of the doubt here, but there's very sharp people on both sides of these discussions, these debates. And if you think that this is an easy thing to answer, you just have not been paying attention.
It just so happens, and I'm not sure why it is exactly, but a lot of worship artists. Yeah. So you have guys like Marty Sampson, this is a number of years ago, Hillsong guy. You have, there's a latest guy from DC Talk. You have guys like Hawk Nelson's, John Steingard.
Oh, guys like that are trouble.
I've thought a little bit about this because they're actually somewhat right here. I do think that people in the worship / sort of music CCM space, it's like the big news on musicians is that they deconvert, and the big news on pastors is that they have a sex scandal. You know,
that's not even funny. I shouldn't laugh at that, but wow.
I don't know if it's true that it's more common with musicians. It kind of sounds true-ish. I don't know exactly what to make of that, but I do think that he's not entirely wrong to observe that, to mention it.
I wonder if Christians would attribute that to maybe that a worship leader's faith isn't as grounded in the stand to reason university apologetics as perhaps the pastors have to be. I don't know.
Yeah, that I could see that argument being made. Technical theological thoughts don't sing very well. And simple emotional appeals always sing better. Music tends to emphasize emotional thoughts rather than theological and technical ones. And so I don't think that musicians necessarily have a shallow view of their faith. Although sometimes it could be true.
I just wonder if that feeds into perception here that they're trying to paint, that if you're leaving for its emotional reasons as opposed to intellectual ones, or at least that's the dichotomy they're painting.
Well, certainly, like, there are plenty of emotional reasons to change your mind on something, but doesn't mean those are the only reasons. And I would push back and say, hey, like, these services that you're having to try and get people converted, they're as emotionally packed as you can possibly make them. It's like, we schedule things like worship music, then a message, really just drive that home. And then an altar call, you've got the guitar going on in the background, the really soft guitar stuff to just set the mood. If emotions are fair to harness when you're trying to convert someone, maybe don't criticize someone for having some emotions when they're deconverting.
Wow, that's an awesome point. Love it.
This story is so powerful, in particular, I think, to the next generation, because they crave, you talk about Gen Z, they're looking at things like authenticity.
Yeah, I think they're right that people are craving authenticity. And I think that's good, right?
No? I would say so.
I see that as a positive thing. It might be fueling deconstruction, but it's also fueling apologetics. Like, apologetics have gotten more popular, but I do feel like a desire to approach our beliefs more authentically and be more certain of them is fueling both sides of these debates, I think.
Would you say that anyone else's deconversion story had any impact on you starting the process?
Oh, good question. I suppose Marty Sampson and Josh Harris are two guys that came out as sort of leaving Christianity within the year before I did. And so I suppose in some way it at least set a precedent where I felt like I had permission to a degree. But I don't know, their processes and their journeys are so different than mine. I don't feel like I was heavily influenced in my thinking by either of them at all.
Because you and I had slightly different journeys to get to a similar place. I didn't know a single person who deconverted, or even a parasocial relationship. There wasn't someone that I was looking at. For me, the closest was Amy Grant got divorced, and that was a big deal. It's like, how dare you?
I remember that. I remember that. That was like a big deal.
I was not influenced at all by some kind of trend or wave of deconstruction stories. It was just a lonely struggle until I came out later and learned that other people had the same.
That was true for me. I didn't hear the word deconstruction until after I had already been down this road. The wave of evangelical deconstructions that we see in the Twitter sphere now, I wasn't aware of any of that. I just had questions and I started reading books and I was horrified by what I found.
On that, we agree, yeah.
It's so ironic to be sitting on this side of the issue, because not too long ago, you know, I was an atheist.
Yeah, I don't think this is the credibility he thinks it is. There are plenty of Christians who aren't familiar with these philosophical questions, and there are plenty of atheists that are also not familiar with these philosophical questions. And I see, looking even just at philosophy of religion Twitter, I see silly arguments on both sides of these things all the time. And so saying that I used to be an atheist isn't necessarily a flex.
But wait, I open every single video with I was a former Christian. I feel called out here.
Okay, so, I mean, well,
that's fair.
I think a Christian might say just because you used to be a Christian doesn't mean that you were an informed one. And you might actually not disagree with that.
I wouldn't actually.
But then I did really in-depth research into it, and I did a lot of reading. Yeah. And was reading Habermas and Lacona and all these guys, Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And then I'm wrestling with it, and I'm coming at it from a completely different perspective. Like, I'm just thinking to myself, man, like, what? I don't understand what it is that's causing these guys because the answers are there. You know, what is it that Rhett and Link and you know, these guys from DC Talk, I thought that was a radio station until recently, man.
I love this so much. Everyone's got different backgrounds, right? No shade. But DC Talk was so big in my world as a kid, so big in my view of my experience of reality, that to think it was a radio station is hilarious to me.
That's right. The question is, to whom are the answers compelling? Because he rattled off a list of books there that I find to be ridiculous.
So he mentions those names. And I think that if you immerse yourself in just that type of literature for long enough, it can become convincing and to a point where you might think, hey, like, how could anyone disagree with this? If you don't engage with some of the counterarguments, I think this can be true on the other side of the equation too. Like,
totally agree.
If you only engage with Bart Ehrman and Richard Carrier and Sam Harris, Dawkins and Hitchens, and if you only engage with their work and you don't read the counterarguments, you might be convinced of a similar thing, that it's just absurd to believe otherwise. And that's why I just think it's important to engage with both sides of these arguments.
John Steingart, for example, he was a lead singer of a band, mm-hmm. and he's done a number of now interviews with Josh McDowell and Sean McDowell, and he was on the Unbelievable podcast, and he does a great job of explaining himself, and he seems very genuine, and he seems like he's really searching for this stuff.
He's buttering you up.
Thanks, John. I feel so affirmed.
But the question that I don't think has been really asked to him is what are you leaving? You know, have you actually tried true Christianity?
Ouch. A stinger.
Have you tried true Christianity?
When people ask questions like this, have you actually tried true Christianity? I just want to say, which one? We have Catholicism, which, like, if you were a Christian for the first 1,000 years of Christianity, you were a Catholic. I grew up in a Protestant tradition that looked at Catholics as if they weren't even real Christians. So, like, even within Christianity, you have people looking at each other being like, well, you're not a real Christian. You're not a real Christian. Before I went through this process of deconstruction, I didn't even understand how much diversity there was within Christianity. I was raised in evangelical Christianity, and I really believed this is the true way to be a Christian. But evangelicalism is like, what, like 100 years old at the most? And so even Protestantism is 500 years old. So there's 1,500 years of tradition before Protestantism was even a thing. And so when you say, have you actually tried true Christianity? What you're really asking is, have you actually tried my Christianity? And you don't want to believe that Christianity is subjective. And yeah, I think it's a wild oversimplification to say that. Because to this day, most Christians in the world are Catholic. And so if anyone was really going to have a right to ask this question, I would think it would be a Catholic.
And then he started off with, I don't think anyone has asked John this. Just for the record, did anyone at any point ask you, have you tried true Christianity, or what were you leaving, or any questions along those ways?
Of course. I've been asked that many times. I've definitely been asked that question.
You heard it here first. All right.
They're expecting everything in the worldview to be perfectly ordered, stackable, wrapped up with a nice, neat little bow.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they realize, wait a second, it's not like that. It's messy.
Oh, it's messy now. What happened to these arguments are easy to answer? So yeah, we do expect that things are going to make sense. I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to ask of an organization called Stand to Reason. I feel like you can say, hey, these are reasonable things, or you can say, God's mysterious, I don't know. But like, you can't like necessarily hold those two things in the same breath.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, John, I think you're making a really important distinction here. And I know some people are going to take it the wrong way.
I did.
Let's just use Tim Barnett as an example, okay?
I like
so
him.
So Tim Barnett grew up in the church. You know, doors were open, we were there, that kind of deal. And yet, in my high school days, you know, I lived like everybody else, my brother and I, and we would party, you know, until 3 in the morning in my last 2 years of high school.
Not partying, not being up till 3 in the morning, say it ain't so. I remember hearing stuff like that in youth group growing up and being like, ooh, partying, that's bad. And I'm just like, wait, it's like only in my adult years am I looking at it and being like, there's not actually anything wrong with being awake at 3 in the morning. I'm awake at 3 in the morning all the time now. It's just now that's when my day is starting instead of finishing because I'm almost 40 and I just wake up early now.
I hear this and I actually want to say, screw you, Tim, because when I was in high school, if I was up till 3 in the morning, I was memorizing scripture and I was praying. Or on a weekend, I might be playing board games with Christian friends drinking soda.
Yeah.
Like, I'm assuming this story is going to be that I didn't really know what it meant to be a Christian when I was in high school, and now I'm much more mature. And so I get why high school student might leave because they're a little shallow. Screw you, Tim. When I was in high school, I was all in on this stuff. I was getting ready to go to Bible college to paint that all high school students are shallow in this way.
It's uncharitable. And I think to a point that we've hit on previously in this conversation, if you are too young to question these things when you're 19, then you're too young to affirm them. right? You can't have it both ways. If you are doing these extravagant youth conferences to try and get people to make a decision for Christ in these formative teenage years, if they're old enough to make that decision, they're also old enough to question. And I just don't think it's fair to say, oh, the default position should be belief and you can't question it until you're 38 like I am.
But in the hindsight, I look back at my lifestyle and I was like, oh my gosh, I was a wretch. Like, yeah. And God reached down into the dark, dank bars of Hollywood and ripped me up into his marvelous light. And he never lets me go. And then when I couple that with hearing these guys' stories, oh man, I just don't get the feeling that they knew. I just don't get the feeling that they really knew that love. That love, because me personally, I can't countenance turning my back on Jesus.
I think John obviously had an experience where his life improved in a way that's really meaningful to him. And Christianity was a part of that experience for him. So clearly it's a meaningful experience that he had. But if you're going to go to experience, then you also have to affirm the people who would say the same about their experience with, say, Islam or Hinduism or people that don't believe at all. And we've already established that it can be difficult to leave a faith. But for a lot of people, and maybe you would be among them, and I think I would be, there were a lot of things I was actually glad to leave behind, beliefs that in retrospect look really restrictive and harmful. And so my experience has been that I feel like leaving Christianity has actually opened up my life in a lot of really positive ways. So if his experience is validating of his beliefs, then my experience is validating of mine, and we're back where we started, just disagreeing.
But again, I actually kind of want to say, screw you, John. I felt the love of, I felt what I attributed to being the love of God throughout my life. I will never forget the feeling I had when I came out of my baptism tank. I felt like I had infinite love pouring into me in that moment. Now, I had family and friends surrounding me, all who were incredibly proud of this step that I'd taken, which probably fed into it. And my own expectations experience had probably fed into it. I experienced what I attributed to be love all the time. I just no longer attribute those feelings to what Jonathan thinks those feelings come from. So yeah. To make this blanket statement that we didn't feel the feelings when 5 minutes ago he was saying we didn't think the right thoughts, I'm a little miffed.
Yeah, that's understandable. I definitely do feel like I've had this hurdled at me a few times over the last year or two. If you just knew the real Jesus, like that kind of thing. And I'm with you. Like I believed really sincerely. And my experience actually was like I was surrounded by people who had these really personal, really emotional experiences with Jesus, or so they believed, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually struggled to have those experiences. I remember trying to conjure up or create the opportunity for these experiences to arise. And I really wanted them. And sometimes I would maybe think I felt something, or like I would experience a voice in my head, like an idea popping out of nowhere, as sometimes happens with all of us. And I would attribute that to God sometimes, because I just really wanted to have these experiences that I saw so many other people having. But I struggled to have them, and I think I was unwilling to manufacture them. And I don't want to sound like I'm accusing anyone of knowingly manufacturing these things, but I think it's possible to have positive experiences and to misattribute them. And I fully admit that I'm still susceptible, but I think we all are.
Think of it like a marriage. You know, if someone were to, if I decided tomorrow to leave my wife, okay, and my kid, my three beautiful daughters, just a deep love, and the next day, gone. What, if I were to ask, let's say you were to ask me, Tim, what are you leaving? You know, what are you leaving? And I say, well, I'm leaving three kids and I'm leaving a wife. You would obviously see that there's something wrong there. I don't really. Where's the love? Where's the Tim just completely broken because he's leaving behind this thing that was so beautiful?
Oh man, I don't feel like I should have to say this, but leaving Christianity and leaving your family are not the same thing. It's like, a marriage is something you undertake as an adult. For many, like myself, Christianity is something that you're brought into as a child, and you didn't necessarily commit to in the same way. So that's a pretty big difference. And then also, there actually are some perfectly good reasons to get out of a marriage. If it's abusive, if it's unhealthy, if there's disagreements that you just can't get past that are really damaging to both of you or just one of you, there are plenty of, I think, perfectly good reasons to end a marriage. Christians get divorced at similar rates to non-believers. So it's not as though being a Christian means you're guaranteed to not get divorced. So nothing about this works for me.
For me, it is entirely not a good analogy. What would be more appropriate would be to say, I was married for 20 years, and then I found out that my wife didn't exist. Or probably, and that, I know that seems silly, so probably more appropriate. And then I found out that my spouse was really an actress. It wasn't what I thought. It was a true lies situation or something where everything that the relationship was built upon wasn't fundamentally true. Then you would be able to walk away and say, okay, I really loved the person who I thought was my wife, but it turns out that wasn't really who my wife was. So it's appropriate then to leave.
Yeah. And it's like to try and steel man him for a second here. I think what he's trying to say is leaving Christianity isn't just leaving a set of ideas or doctrines. It's leaving something that is loving. And if you had that, you wouldn't leave. I think that's what he's trying to say, maybe.
Even if you really loved someone, if you found out they were on a fundamental level lying to you or something that you assumed about that person's character turned out not to be the case, it doesn't matter whether or not there was genuine love there.
And so this is where the bumpers that they mentioned earlier in the video right. come into play. It's like the love is connected to an unwillingness to actually question the deeper fundamental questions.
Right.
We're never going to understand the mind of God. Yeah. But it doesn't mean like we don't wrestle towards that understanding, you know, mm-hmm. and I can't think of another faith in another worldview that actually calls for us. I mean, it's calling us. Hey, test me on this.
That's literally describing the scientific method. That's a worldview that is the most dedicated to testing things and throwing out things that aren't true.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Test. I think that's what people are doing when they're engaging with these questions.
I was listening to John Steingard, and he was saying that he went on a missions trip to Uganda, and he worked among this group of pygmies, and he couldn't reconcile a good God with the immense suffering and pain that he saw within this community of people who have been displaced.
Yeah, it wasn't a missions trip. I was doing a documentary film, so I feel like that's worth saying because the term missions trip has a lot of connotations that I wouldn't want to buy into. But yeah, I was there doing a documentary film about this people group, the Batwa, and I just saw suffering on a level that I had never seen before. This is what instigated my interest in the problem of evil because I really saw things that just, I was just like I grew up believing that God is a God that intervenes, that's active in the world. And I just had a hard time while I was there imagining that this God who's all loving and all powerful and active in the world would be fine with the level of suffering that I saw. Most of the kids in this community don't make it to the age of 5. And I had just become a father myself. I was watching 4-year-olds take care of 2-year-olds because they had no one else. For me personally, it put me in a place where I had a very hard time believing in the God that is so involved in your life that he saves a parking spot for you at church. Oh, I just prayed and God, I just, you know, provided the perfect parking spot. Cool. There's 2-year-olds being parented by 4-year-olds in Uganda. So maybe I'd be fine with giving up a parking spot if God wanted to spend some time over there. That's the feeling I came back with. I recognize that's emotional, and I'm not saying that is the entirety of my sort of objection, but I definitely, that kicked off my interest in the problem of evil, or the problem of suffering, as I like to call it. I just saw this suffering that flew in the face of everything I'd always believed about God and reality, and it really kicked off questioning for me.
Well, what does your new belief get you? Like, how does your new belief, how does rejecting God, throwing God off, how does that move you towards a solution to the supposed problem?
It doesn't move you toward a solution. Like, I was seeing this suffering in Uganda, and I didn't have a solution. I remember thinking, like, how much money is in my bank account? How, like, can I fix this? And the problem was too big for me to fix it. And so while I was there, I was like, the best thing I can do is make the best film I know how to make to get this in front of as many people as possible so that people will be motivated to help. I don't see God doing any lifting here. Everyone that was there on the ground actually helping was human beings. And it actually was a Christian organization. And so I appreciate that their faith is tied up in their desire to help, but it's the physical act of helping, the real work that people are doing on the ground that was so powerful to me and that I wanted to motivate people to do more of. And so questioning or even departing Christianity doesn't solve the problem of suffering, but it's reasonable if you see this horrible amount of suffering to question why it exists if there is a God that's all-loving, all-powerful, and all-knowing, like we've said. So it doesn't fix the problem, but the suffering really highlights an inconsistency, an internal inconsistency in the beliefs that I held.
There's two senses in which this is a problem of suffering. There is the problem of suffering in that we, as human beings, our empathy wishes that there was less suffering. We would like to figure out ways to reduce that. So that is one sense a problem. The problem of evil or the problem of suffering from an argument for God perspective is an internal critique saying that the suffering that we see is incompatible with the proposition that you're putting forth. They're two whole separate things.
Totally agree. Yep.
And so just the fact that they can be given the same label causes some conflation. And I think both sides should be careful which thing we're talking about.
I want to know what you're leaving, but I also want to know where you're going. And yeah. I think that they might say, well, I don't know where I'm going. And that's, I guess that's fair, but.
Okay. So I want to know what you're leaving, but I also want to know where you're going. That is what a controlling ex-boyfriend would say to a girl who's leaving him. That's a very manipulative question, I think, because if you're in an unhealthy relationship and you leave, you might not know where you're going, but that's not a good reason to stay. I don't think this is a question anyone who's deconverting or deconstructing needs to answer. He even admitted a perfectly reasonable answer is, I don't know, but I know that there's something not right here and I'm not going to ignore it.
It makes Christianity entirely utilitarian as opposed to, is it true or not? I left Christianity because I don't think it's true, not because I don't think there is some utility to it. Tim's basically saying, if you can't show me something that has more utility, you should stick where you are, which is a weird non-selfish Pascal's wager or something. I'm not.
Yeah. And if you're looking for utility, like I would argue Jainism, Buddhism, Taoism have a lot less baggage as far as like the sort of negative side effects. I think this might've been Sam Harris, but like an extremist Jain is going to be the kindest, most wonderful soul you've ever met. So yeah, I'll take that kind of extremism and fundamentalism any day.
Exactly. And I now know, I didn't know at the time, I didn't even know this was a thing, but secular humanism is basically based on the second thing that Jesus says. He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul, your mind. That's the first commandment. But the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you just take that second part, love your neighbor as yourself, then you have secular humanism. And that's all you need, because the first commandment really doesn't impact how you operate in the world. It's only the second one.
Sometimes you'll hear people say, if you don't believe in God, like, then what motivation do you even have to be moral, to be good? Like, why not just do awful things all the time? And I'm just, do you really feel like if there was no God to punish you, that you would just be a horrible person? Is that what you think about yourself? I believe better of you than that. I believe that you want to do good because it actually like is good to do good. I think that your life is benefited when you live it in a moral way. And I don't think that you need to have a God looking over your shoulder, threatening to punish you in order for that to be true.
And in fact, if I encounter someone like that, then I generally say, well, I hope you remain a Christian then.
I think that if you ask them, where do you think you're headed? You're asking them, what do you plan on believing in the future? Without giving them the opportunity to really consider it. So I think the only appropriate answer for people that are in the middle of this like deconstruction, deconversion process, generally, you're going to want to say, I don't know, and then refuse to decide on an endpoint before you've done the thinking and the reading and the contemplating.
And that stuff doesn't help because people have a sin nature. When sin is pervasive, well, you throw more money at it, more education, more time, more programs. Well, and you just it's a cyclical thing that that once you're in, it's hard to get out of.
Yeah, I just don't understand vilifying people that are going out and doing actual, real, tangible work to help alleviate suffering in the world. I don't think he actually means that. I've got to believe that he would look at organizations like Charity Water, which is a secular organization that brings clean water to places where there isn't clean water. I've got to believe that he would look at that and think that's a good thing. It sounds like he's saying that it's pointless. I want to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that he doesn't actually believe that.
I've been in Christian circles, unfortunately. I'm very pleased to have grown up in a Mennonite tradition where if anything bad happened in the world, we would run out and do stuff. And I grew up in that great tradition. But
that's
at the
great.
Same time, they would pull out the verse, "You'll always have the poor among you." Basically, we're not on earth to make this better. When we give someone a cup of water, we're doing that because we might be entertaining an angel.
Oh, so it's selfish again.
Or it's, here's a cup of water and a tract.
Right.
That's one of the problems I have with Franklin Graham's organizations. Here's a couple of pencils, but you have to quote some Bible verses first.
Yeah, that feels a little icky.
Yeah.
Or a lot icky.
I know you're giving Jonathan a lot of benefit of doubt. I'm not sure.
If I were talking to him, I would want to understand what he means by cyclical there. The idea that helping people in the moment doesn't necessarily fix the problem.
As he was describing that, I was thinking of his own ministry that he works for. Stands a Reason, being an evangelist and an apologist, is also incredibly cyclical. Didn't you do evangelism in the 50s? Why are you still doing it?
Yeah, eating is cyclical. Why have a meal? You're just going to get hungry again.
But they're fashioning a God after their own image, ultimately.
Which is what I often think Christians are doing.
Now, I don't know John Steingart's position currently, as far as morality goes, but I know that he did cite instance of terrible evil that he saw on one of his mission trips. Now, it would be very strange if he now moves away from objective morality into some kind of subjectivism, because that's where his original challenge That's what his original challenge is, based on some kind of objective standard.
Okay, three things here. First off, I didn't cite an instance of evil. I cited an instance of suffering. Remember, we're demoralizing this conversation. Suffering. And then John said, this really is evil. No, it really is suffering. And then also, like, maybe he's not aware, but outside of faith circles, theistic circles, there are plenty of people who are atheists that are moral objectivists that do believe that morality is objective. I have done a bunch of reading on morality, and I don't exactly know where I land these days. Sometimes it feels a little like semantics, like depending on how you word it, depending what you mean by morality, it can be subjective or objective, just depending on how you're talking about it. So I don't boldly declare myself a moral subjectivist or objectivist. I'm still a student of morality. But there are plenty of atheist philosophers who are moral objectivists. So rejecting Christianity doesn't mean you're automatically a moral subjectivist. So I would disagree with that false dichotomy. And then also, like you and I have both said, this is an internal critique, right? I'm pointing out an inconsistency between two things that Christianity affirms in general. And I don't think I have to stand on anything to do that.
I mean, this goes back to that famous C.S. Lewis quote where he talks about, as an atheist, his argument against God was that the world seemed so cruel and unjust. But then he asks, how had I got this idea of just and unjust? Right? A man doesn't call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line.
Even though C.S. Lewis is one of my favorite authors, this line has always puzzled me a little bit, because it feels like it's not that difficult to respond to, in the sense that, like, we've all experienced suffering in life, hard things that are not difficult to see that our life would be better without. And when Lewis says you have to have some understanding of a straight line, there doesn't actually have to exist a straight line in order to imagine what a straight line could be, because you see some lines that are less crooked than other lines. And then you can imagine, oh, a straight line would be a line that has no crookedness at all. But that doesn't mean that it exists.
Or I actually like to change Lewis's analogy a little bit. To me, it's more like saying you can have two sticks and know which is longer without having any idea of what the most long thing is.
I love that. That's an even better way of saying it. You should go with that.
That piece, now you're just rejecting it altogether. You needed that, you know, to make your case against Christianity.
No, you didn't. Setting aside the fact that it's perfectly coherent to be an atheist and also a moral objectivist. If Christians are saying we get our morality from the Bible, I'm just like, where exactly, right? Because we're talking about an internal critique, right? There's things in the Bible that are pretty horrifying. And nobody kills more people in the Bible than God does. Even right down to the idea of if you believe in hell as eternal conscious torment, after you die, if you don't make the right decision as far as following Jesus and believing in Jesus, then you burn forever. And like, I think it was Augustine that painted this picture of God regenerating your skin so he could burn it back off again. And it's like, that's your vision of God, where that's where he throws people and you've missed your chance to make a decision. Otherwise, like, your time's up. This is your experience now for eternity. Again, it's, this is an internal critique, and where we get our morality doesn't really need to matter to this critique.
I think that you got this from, the conversation between Sean McDowell and the genetically modified skeptic.
Yeah.
Okay, so our kids, right? We have kids about the same age, all girls between us. It's like ridiculous. All girls, lots of drama.
Yeah, we have all girls, lots of drama. That's not misogynistic at all. It just slips in there sometimes.
Yeah.
And your kids come to you and say, look, I'm deconstructing, or I'm deconverting, or I think I'm an atheist now. What do you say? And Drew wishes that people would have said in his community,
the number one thing that you can do, and this needs to be first, the first thing, express your unconditional love for them.
I love you, period. Not I love you, but so cool. this, and this. Just I love you. That's it.
I love this. And this is something where I've got to give Tim and John some credit here. I really appreciate that they're emphasizing this point. I do feel like I have people in my life who responded this way to me when I started deeply questioning things. And I'm really grateful for that. I feel for people who don't have people in their lives that respond that way. Because I know plenty of people who've gone through deconversions and deconstructions, whatever, and didn't have anyone in their life that responded like that. I don't know. What was your experience?
First, I want to say you can give them credit for emphasizing it, and I'm glad they are. But sadly, it took them watching an interview with my friend Drew, an interview with an atheist, for them to realize, oh, we Christians should be loving first.
Okay, that's a fair point. Yeah.
Fortunately for me, there was a handful of people in my life who did exactly that. We love you no matter what. I don't know how I would have got through it if not for that. And I've witnessed firsthand many people for whom not a single person continues to show them love. And that is awful and that sucks. So I was a lucky one, but I know that not everyone is. I've adopted this with my children and my family who are Christians. I say the exact same thing back. I love you no matter what we disagree upon. And I emphasize that as much as possible because no disagreement is worth losing some of those relationships.
Yeah, totally agree.
What's second point? So Drew said, I never would have thought of this. I never would have thought of this.
Thank you for being willing to tell me. Like, I'm sure that this is not, especially if you're in a Christian community, and that's a big part of your life, saying, I would want to say thank you to my child for being open to telling me. I know that that's not easy, especially when they're going to know that I'm going to want to influence what they think.
Thanking them for being honest and open with you. Because I think there's a lot of young people who are struggling and they don't think they don't feel safe going to mom or dad. They don't feel safe going to the youth pastor because they think they're going to get, you know, judged or whatever. Okay. They're going to get arguments beat down their throat or something, Bibles thrown at them. I don't know. They just don't feel safe.
Yeah. I really am glad that Drew instigated this line of thinking for Tim and John here, because it is true. A lot of people don't feel safe going to mom and dad, don't feel safe going to their youth pastor or their pastor. And I think part of that loops all the way back to what we heard at the very beginning of this conversation about only approach these questions with your bumpers up, with your parameters set, with the understanding that God is this, that X, Y, and Z. When you're approaching these questions like that, yeah, people that start to question the fundamental things aren't going to feel safe bringing those questions to you because they recognize that you're not willing to entertain the really hard questions.
So look, there's going to be times where we can get together and talk. Not every time. We're not going to talk about Jesus every time, but we will talk. Maybe you can expand on that.
What did you take away from this?
I feel like this conversation between Tim and John bounces around a lot, right? There's at one point where the answers are obvious and clear. And then at another point where it's, well, this stuff is messy and you shouldn't ask for it to be super ordered and with a bow on it. I get frustrated with the constant insistence to bring morality into a question about suffering. Like I've said to you, I prefer to think about the problem of evil as the problem of suffering. So we can see it, in my view, a little bit more clearly. I think a lot of times the Christian response to the problem of evil is to focus on the moral side of it. But what they're doing is they're sidestepping the problem. They're not really addressing the problem. They're creatively dismissing it. If someone's going through a process of deconstruction or deconversion, they might not be familiar enough with these topics to realize that's what's going on. And so they might feel like, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. But they won't be satisfied. They'll just feel dismissed. And I think my advice to Christians would be like, be careful that your approach is not dismissive in this way, and really be willing to entertain the hard questions, because like we've said, there are smart people on both sides of these conversations. And so maybe if someone in your life is coming to you with questions, and it, instead of knee-jerk responding with creative ways of dismissing those questions, maybe let that motivate you to engage with the questions yourself a little more deeply. And to someone who's deconstructing or deconverting, if you ever feel like your questions are being dismissed and not actually really addressed, you should feel free to notice that and to not be just shrink away and be like, oh, this person has read a few more books than me. Follow your intuition and be patient. Be kind with yourself. This is a hard process. Recognize that there's going to be a little bit of frustration and sometimes pain, and try and find places where you really do feel like you can address these questions in spaces where they're taken seriously. What do you think?
I got a little frustrated in a few places because of the assumptions that they were making about the people who were deconstructing. I heartily endorse Drew's first two steps that a Christian should take with someone who's deconstructing, and that is to love them, and then second of all, to thank them for trusting them. I think what I would like to push now forward is the third and fourth things that you should do. The third thing is, don't assume that you know why they are leaving, and don't paint with broad brush. So we heard in this video, you just want to sin. We heard in this video, you didn't have the right theology. And then we heard, you didn't have the right emotions. Some of those may be true. None of those may be true. I feel like those things are only helpful within the flock so that they can explain away why people are leaving. John, when you first left, it was a ripple that I felt that people were trying to explain away why you left, to try and keep the kids in, to fortify the walls. These men both work for Greg Kokel, whose famous book, Tactics, on how to have these conversations. Greg would say, what do you mean by that? And how did you come to that conclusion? I never heard Tim or John in this conversation advocating going to the person and literally asking that question. Instead, they wanted to put up the safety bumpers. They don't want to hear the reasons that a deconstructed person might have. And I think that's a huge mistake, because perhaps that person did leave for poor reasons, and you can give them good reasons if you're a Christian. And also, perhaps that person did learn something that would be great for you to think about.
I think those are great takeaways. And while you were talking, I thought of another one. I think it's important to approach these questions with curiosity, with the assumption that there might be things that you still have to learn. You might find yourself convinced of a number of things in any given moment, but hold it loosely enough to recognize that if you were confronted with ideas or evidence that pointed in another direction, that you'd actually be willing to look at that. And from knowing you, Paul, I think it's fair to say that if you were presented with new evidence in favor of Christianity, that you would really consider it. Everything I know of you tells me that is true. And I hope that's true for me too. And I strive for that. In the last year, my position on theism in general has changed because I've recognized that it was important for me to decouple my criticisms of Christianity from my criticisms of theism in general. And I just think it's important for all of us to approach these questions with that sort of openness.
You know, where it's like, okay, maybe I'm laying it on a little too heavy for her. So, wow, this is like the fastest hour I've ever experienced in my entire life.
Well, that's hardly an endorsement for how great your life is, but I understand the sentiment. And on my end, time always flies when John Steingart is involved.
Great. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I love batting these things around. And hopefully at some point we'll actually get to hang in person someday. I'd really enjoy that.
Me too. John's kind of enjoying some time as a private citizen these days. But you can find the link to his YouTube channel in the description, where he hosted an excellent conversation with a handsome Canadian, and also a link to his Twitter,
where he still periodically interacts with religious and apologetics topics. Subscribe and follow and let him know that Apologia sent you. And if the time flew for you as well, tap on the thumbnail on screen now for more. See you over there.
Sweet. See ya.
Later.